Okay. I decided to do this calculation quickly. It's got some messy details that are maybe not so exciting, but I wanted to just do one example of a calculation with a chemical potential. So the setup is a universe with four species: protons, electrons, neutral hydrogen, and photons, that are interacting by this binding interaction. And what will happen is that the ionization fraction, or the ratio of, let's say, ionized electrons to total baryons, will be very close to one for a long time, and then it will suddenly drop at a redshift of around 1,000. And then the reaction will freeze out, just like we saw in the case of dark matter annihilation, at an ionization fraction of around 10 to the minus 3. My notes from last time, I had both I was going to calculate both what happened in this initial period when the species are thermal, and then calculate when freeze out occurred. But I think I'm going to shortcut it and just talk about the first part. So I just want to derive this Xe being close to one and then dropping very suddenly. So this is an example of a situation where you need a chemical potential. So I want to write the mean occupation numbers of. Last time I said I was going to assume that the photons were an unperturbed black body, since there are so many of them compared to the other species. I'm going to write the distribution function of these other three species with the chemical potential mu I. Look, I'll say in a minute why I'm putting the chemical potentials. So I want to solve for, I'll solve for the thermal history if I can. Oh, for three unknowns, functions of time, the three chemical potentials. And to solve for those three unknowns, I need three equations. And so there's one equation that says that the chemical potentials of the protons and the electrons have to add up to the chemical potential of the hydrogen. I guess strictly speaking, there's a plus mu gamma on this side, but that was zero by assumption, since I'm assuming that the photons are an unperturbed black body. You generally have an equation like this when you have a reaction like this that's converting species from one to the other. So you would not have a chemical potential if you had so many reactions that including reactions that could just don't conserve number of particles, that all the chemical potentials are forced to be zero. And that is the case in the very early universe. That was in the case of the thermal history that we were considering before. But here in the late universe, most reactions have frozen out, and there's only one left. And so you end up with chemical potential. That's one equation. And then the other two equations. So in general, you end up with as many independent chemical potentials as there are conserved quantities. And here there are two conserved quantities, which provide the other two equations. Electric charge is conserved. And then finally, baryon number is conserved, where NB is this function of scale factor. And so conceptually, what we want to do is solve these three equations and three unknowns. And a convenient way to do that is to eliminate chemical potentials in terms of number densities. Favor of Ni. Okay. So let me say that if you I know we're really familiar with these integrals. They're like counting particles. Only difference is now I have a chemical potential. Now, I leave it for you to show that in the non-relativistic limit, if this is plus for the protons, then you end up with this. And you get the same thing for the other two species, but with the proton mass replaced by the electron mass, of course. And likewise for the chemical potential. And then in the case of hydrogen, there's this little detail that the G in front is 4 rather than 2. Now, you incorporate the constraint labeled equation number 1. You might notice that if you form this ratio, then I'm going to end up with the point is that the chemical potentials cancel out. And then I'll write this as I'll write this first bit as mu to the 3/2. Technically, that's an approximation since the proton mass is slightly different from the hydrogen mass. Times e to the minus b over t, where b is the binding energy, or the sum of the masses of the two binding particles minus the mass of the bound state, 1.6 eV.
The sign of our
emitter. Oh, yes, thank you. Yes, right. Oh, yeah. We got 1 out of 3 signs correct. Okay. Now I've incorporated the constraint labeled 1. To incorporate 2 and 3, I'll solve these constraints, so to speak, by writing NP equals NE, by introducing the ionization fraction XE. And writing the abundances this way. And this equation becomes, gives an equation that you can solve for the ionization fraction. Okay. So that's the solution, and that we have an equation that gives the ionization fraction as a function of temperature. This is usually written in a slightly different way by using these equations that I put over here under setup. You can write it this way. It's just a bunch of physical constants times a function of B over T. And the point of writing it this way is that it brings out a very large dimensionless prefactor. All right, so this is a famous equation called the Saha equation. It just gives the ionization fraction at recombination as a function of temperature. This is, I would say this is a moderately famous equation in cosmology and a really famous equation in stellar astrophysics, where it gives the ionization fraction and the strength of spectral lines in stellar atmospheres. Anyway, the point of the dimensionless prefactor, if you think about this equation qualitatively, as the temperature decreases, let me draw a plot with decreasing temperature going to the right, and then here's the binding energy of hydrogen. As the temperature decreases, this factor is becoming exponentially small. But then there's this huge prefactor in the front. So the right-hand side doesn't actually reach order one until the temperature is around B over 40, is 0.3 eV. The huge prefactor is a combination of two things, both the low baryon to photon ratio and the fact that the electron mass is much larger than the binding energy of neutral hydrogen. And then, once you're out here, then on the right-hand side, I have this huge factor times e to the minus 40. And now if I make it a little larger, if I make it 10% larger from e to the minus 40 to e to the minus 44, then it decreases a lot. And that's why there's this very sudden drop off. Okay. We could go a little further and put in a little bit of atomic physics for the cross section and figure out that the reaction freezes out at an abundance of around 10 to the minus 3. As in the dark matter case, the case of dark matter decoupling, the freeze out is not driven by the temperature dependence of the cross section, but rather by the exponential fall off. Okay. This really simple calculation that it neglected excited states of hydrogen and a bunch of other things gives qualitatively the right answer. The true history is a lot more extended than this calculation would suggest, but settles into something which is a little bit lower, but within a factor of two of what the simple freeze-out calculation predicts. By the way, the true ionization history, there's been an incredible amount of work in the cosmology literature calculating this ionization history to predict the statistics of the CMB on small angular scales. This needs to be known to something like 0.1%. One of the biggest accomplishments of modern cosmology are the computer programs where you can press a button and get like the CMB power spectrum for any set of cosmological parameters. And I would say that in total, that's like a heroic calculation where if you put all the important papers together, it would be like thousands of papers by hundreds of physicists. A significant fraction of it is just figuring out how to get this right. There's lots of couplings between excited states of hydrogen, which are quite complicated and take 50 pages, 50 page technical papers to work out. I just wanted to put this up because it just felt incomplete. The discussion of thermal history felt incomplete without an example of a calculation that used the chemical potential. It finishes up everything. I was going to cover three topics in the course, expansion history, thermal history, and then next I wanted to, I'm going to talk about inflation in the very early universe. Up until now, I've been assuming that the universe is spatially homogeneous and just sort of figuring out what happens to the background. And inflation is the first case where we, we're going to be tracking the evolution of perturbations. In a longer course, there would be a sort of like more topics, like we'd track the perturbations through inflation and then through the formation of the CMB and then large scale structure in the late universe. It's a little too much for the sci format, so I'm just going to talk about, I'm going to use the remaining time to give sort of a complete description of what happens in the very early universe and how the initial perturbations get generated. So inflation is a theory about what happened in the very early universe before the hot Big Bang. And it's often motivated as by the so-called horizon problem, which is the following statement. If I plot the I make a space-time diagram of the universe, and I'll do it in conformal time, where the light cones are straight lines. And as you saw in problem set one, the total past conformal time of our universe is finite, assuming a radiation-dominated beginning. So there's a Big Bang. When we look back to the CMB, we're looking most of the way back to the Big Bang in conformal time. This amount of conformal time is about 1% of the total. When we look at the CMB on like opposite sides of our sky, or any two sky locations that are separated by more than a degree or so, and we're looking at CMB fluctuations which were formed before they were ever in causal contact. So then it seems a bit mysterious that the CMB is nearly isothermal, suggesting that all parts of the CMB were once in causal contact and were able to equilibrate to a common temperature. Now, as you showed in the problem set, if this were your only clue for what was happening in the very early universe before the hot Big Bang, then as you showed in the to solve this horizon problem, we just want to speculate that before the hot Big Bang, there was some phase of the early universe where the total past conformal time was infinite, or at least very large. As you showed in the first problem set, the condition for that is that W is less than minus 1/3. So any phase of the universe at high energies with equation of state less than minus 1/3 would solve the horizon problem, in the sense that it would bring all parts of our CMB into causal contact at some point in the past. Now, the way that I like to think about the horizon problem is to say that with modern data, we have a lot more information. Going beyond the statement that the CMB is nearly isothermal, we know nowadays we've mapped out the perturbations of the CMB quite accurately. And we know a lot about the initial conditions of the universe. In particular, I'm going to sort of make some statements about what the initial conditions need to look like to be consistent with our CMB. And then, as usual, I'll have to make some hand-waving statements so that we actually know that. One thing that's been tested to really high accuracy is that the initial metric perturbations have to take this form, where I've taken the usual FRW metric, which is an approximation that describes the universe without spatial perturbation. And I've just included this factor, which depends on space but not time. This function zeta is called the adiabatic curvature. One thing that has been tested to very high accuracy in the CMB, something like 1 part in 10 to the 3, is that theta is a so-called Gaussian field, which an operational definition of that statement is that Each Fourier mode zeta of k is an independent Gaussian random variable. You play with the CMB map, and Gaussianness is sort of staring you in the face. For example, you do an experiment of downloading a CMB map and histogramming all of the temperatures. So the number of points in the histogram would be the number of pixels in the map. Then you'll get the bell curve like perfectly within the statistical errors of millions of pixels. Whereas another experiment, if you take you histogram all pairs of points on our CMB sky with two temperatures at a fixed separation, then you'll find that this 2D histogram perfectly matches a multivariate Gaussian with a level of correlation that depends on the separation between the points. So the Gaussianness of our CMB has been tested to about 1 part in 10 to the 3. And since the CMB is the formation of the CMB from the initial conditions is a linear process, that reflects some Gaussianness that's built into the initial fluctuations of our universe. And then the second statement that I want to make is that theta is nearly scale invariant. And I'll give a more mathematical definition of what this means later. But
well, S of the zeta of k, have you written what is that independence variable?
Each Fourier mode.
Each.
So if you wanted to like simulate each Fourier mode. Like if you wanted to simulate the initial conditions of our universe on the computer, what you could do is take so let's say our observable universe is there's some maximum radius we can observe. So it's some sphere in a larger universe. And you can just surround it by a big 3D periodic box and then loop over Fourier modes of the box and generate a Gaussian random number for each Fourier mode. And as far as we can tell in the CMB, that would be a perfect computer simulation of our universe. And then there's one more property. So the statement that that zeta is a Gaussian field doesn't tell you how the amplitudes of zeta of k depend on scale k. And so there I want to say what scale invariant means is that if I have a random realization of zeta in a big box and I zoom in on a small box, that it's statistically indistinguishable from the original box. This is not perfectly true. The size of the fluctuations to the variance theta squared goes as the length scale of the box to the 0.04 plus or minus 0.01. The point is that we have a lot of information about the initial conditions that we can infer from our CMB. So this makes the horizon problem a lot more interesting since, if you leave out the information on the right-hand side of the board, then I think all we could really conclude is that W is less than minus one-third in the early universe, which is not very, not a very distinctive piece of information that points to like one type of physics over the other. But if you add in the information on the right side of the board, now we have some like really sharp prediction that we're trying to explain. It's some sort of clue for the physics before the hot Big Bang.
Is that point not, means my idea of inflation was that inflation was something after the singularity, right?
I suppose I should have said that when we say that there's a singularity at a equals zero, what we really mean, at least I think the only reasonable interpretation, is that as we approach the singularity, the temperature of the universe gets hotter and hotter. And that at those high energies, at some point, some new physics must take over. The singularity would be absent. It's more of a statement that we've lost our ability to predict. So the way that inflation is going to work is that there'll be some other physics that I'll write down in a minute. There'll be a transition to a radiation-dominated universe at some high temperature.
So by the inflation hypothesis, we are saying there is no singularity. There was no singularity in the past.
Yeah, or at least we can get rid of this. But then you might ask what came before inflation. So it's not so easy to find a model of physics that would produce perturbations that satisfy these properties. Inflation is the first historical first attempt. It's sort of amazing that something this simple works. The version of inflation that I'm going to talk about, I can write the action down in a few terms. So inflation is a theory for the very early universe at high energies, where the only fields are the metric and a scalar field phi. The action consists of three terms. There's the usual Einstein-Hilbert action for gravity, not involving the new field phi. Then there's the so-called minimal coupling, which is the simplest way of coupling a scalar field to the metric. With my sign convention for the metric, this kinetic term would have a minus thing. The only sort of novel ingredient is this potential, which has to be at a fairly large energy to dominate the stress energy of the universe. The other thing about the potential that I'll tell you in advance, just so you could have a picture in mind, is that the potential, it turns out, needs to be nearly flat, which means that it's first and second derivatives, or rather the first and second derivatives of log of e, are small in Planck units. I say that's a nearly flat potential. With this simple universe with just gravity waves and a scalar field, it turns out that if this potential is nearly flat, if you start this theory off in its ground state, then there's a quantum mechanical mechanism for producing field fluctuations, which produce fluctuations of exactly the type that we need to be the metric fluctuations at the beginning of our universe. The flatness conditions turn out to be required to get the near scale invariance, but that's something that's totally not obvious in advance that will like emerge from some calculation. Here's something about inflation that I think is really physically interesting. So I'm going to claim that there are like two ways to get Gaussian random variables in nature. One way is by the central limit theorem. If I'm adding up a bunch of uncorrelated randomness, then it always Gaussianizes. So like the x component of the velocity of an air molecule in this room is a Gaussian random variable because it's the random outcome of many uncorrelated collisions. But I'm going to claim that there's a second way, which is that in quantum mechanics, Gaussian wave functions are ubiquitous, like the ground state wave function of a harmonic oscillator, something like the minus omega x squared. So if I prepare a bunch of harmonic oscillators in their ground states, and then I do an experiment where I observe them in their position space basis, and what I get is like a natural Gaussian random number generator. The result of that experiment is indistinguishable from a random number generator that generates Gaussian random numbers. Something similar happens in quantum field theory. Since quantum field theory, or at least perturbative quantum field theory, is like modeling the universe as a bunch of harmonic oscillators, then at the end of inflation, the universe will have a wave function. And if I observe this wave function, if I observe the realization of the metric at the end of inflation, then the result is like a natural Gaussian random number generator that generates the same type of random field that I talked about in this computer simulation picture. One more comment on inflation. Two more comments. First off, inflation has sort of grown over time to become like this large paradigm with many different variants. And I'm just describing the simplest variant, which is single field slow roll inflation. Slow roll means that the potential satisfies these flatness conditions. But there are many variants with like more complicated couplings and multiple fields and so on. The second comment is that you might wonder like what came before inflation. There is sort of a sense in which the theory of inflation also has a horizon problem. There are theorems that say that inflationary spacetimes are always geodesically incomplete, meaning that if I take an observer and draw a geodesic, let's say the observer has some small initial velocity, draw a geodesic, then it reaches the beginning of the inflationary spacetime and finite proper time, so that if you carry a clock back, it falls off the edge of the universe. That must be a theory sign that the theory of inflation is somehow incomplete. But unlike the horizon problem that separates the hot Big Bang from inflation, we don't really have any observational clues. The only thing we know about the inflationary initial conditions is that you have to start in the vacuum state of the theory. The way inflation works, you start in the vacuum state with no fluctuations, no particles, and then some quantum mechanical, QFT magic happens, and then you get fluctuations at the end. But just the statement that the theory has to start in its vacuum state seems to be such a weak constraint on what came before that it's hard for me to see how you could ever test hypotheses about what came before inflation. Okay. So now I want to get into the physics. And this last part of the class will involve some sort of heavy-duty GR. So I want to start deriving things like equations of motion for this action. But I also really like to review the GR foundations. Just because I think really learning like the ins and outs of GR is a really useful thing to get out of a first cosmology class. So I want to start by talking about integration by parts in GR. Okay. There are four integrals that you might get in GR. And some of these, assuming no boundary terms, some of these are guaranteed to be zero and some of them aren't. Anyone want to guess which ones are zero?
First and last.
Correct. Okay. Now this one, I think, requires no explanation. It's just a property of derivatives that has nothing to do with the metric or anything. But this one is not so obvious. Can you, or can anyone give me a reason why this is the case?
Because if you write the covariant derivative in terms of a specific formula, which is 1 by root g, and means you can convert it in a form which has a 1 by root g in front, and the other part is just d mu of some quantity.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic. So this formula, formula is sometimes called the Voss-Weil formula. So it's both like a can be a convenient computational shortcut. If I have the divergence of a vector field in GR, then I can calculate it this way, that where I don't need Christoffel symbols. But it's also like the basis for integration by parts in GR, because it means that integrals like this need to be zero. By the way, the reason in GR that there are so many integrals with square root minus g in them, for example, the Einstein-Hilbert action, is that any integral with the form d4x square root minus g times a scalar quantity like r is independent of the coordinate system, because the d4x and the square root minus g have like opposite powers of the Jacobian under coordinate transformation. Okay, so in the calculations that we'll do, we'll rarely see integrals that look like this, and we'll often see integrals. So this is the basis for integration by parts in GR. I want to put up some examples of integrations by parts. And then you can tell me which of these are correct and which of them I screwed up. First one, I integrated by parts to put the covariant derivative on the up. And here's one with two scalars where I added to the Laplacian and one of the scalars. Here's one where I so all of these would be okay in flat space. And this last one, I integrated by parts twice. I put the nu derivative over here and the mu derivative over here. Okay. I'll let you guys stare at these for a minute and then tell me which ones you think are correct. Pull backwards around. Let me know if there are any handwriting issues. Handwriting, blackboard handwriting is not the best. What do you guys think? Feel free to shout out opinions on any one of these three.
First one is right.
Yeah, the first one is fine. Like this, so this formula means that you know, just to write out the first one in detail. The point is that the integration by parts like goes through the square, if it's a covariant derivative, it like goes through the square root g, so to speak. The reason for that is that if I write I write the first one this way. The left-hand side is just is equal to this by general property of the covariant derivative. Then this piece vanishes. What do you think about the second or the third one? Sorry, I should have said this piece vanishes by this formula.
Second should also be right.
Yeah, the second one is also okay. In fact, if I
treat one of them as x mu.
Yeah, right. If I relabeled the covariant derivative of psi, the upper covariant derivative, I relabeled it x mu. Then it's the same as the first one. You can always in general, you can always take like the outermost covariant derivative and move it over to the other factor when integrating that part. Now, you probably guessed that there's a problem with the third one. It wouldn't be much of a quiz if they were all right. does anyone have a thought on what the problem might be? Start writing it out.
Right.
So it's easy. Yeah, it's really easy to make this mistake. So if you just like in you know, in flat space, you sometimes get boundary terms in integration by parts. In GR, you can sometimes get curvature terms. So what will happen here is integration by parts is always OK as long as I'm moving around the outermost derivative. So in this first step, I'll move this nabla mu over here. I'm going to go ahead and move indices around. Let's find it less confusing if they're in this order. I switched the upper and lower nus. By the way, that's OK because the covariant derivative commutes with the metric. If you look at where I wanted to end up over there, the next thing I wanted to do is bring the new covariant derivative over. For that to be OK, it would have to be on the outside. That means I have to commute the covariant derivatives. And then I pick up a curvature term. So with the displacement. Then with that is just do one thing in the step, which is recognize this as the Ricci curvature with a minus sign. And so then I can do the integration by parts on the first term. So what I end up with is the flat space result that I expected. That's a term proportional to the Ricci curvature. This should be minus that. The Ricci curvature often arises when integrating by parts. Okay. I want to calculate the equation of motion for the scalar field phi from this action. So I'm going to vary this action with respect to phi. Varying the first term gives zero. It's a purely gravitational term. And then, where am I good? We get two terms that are both this. This term I get v prime of phi times delta phi. And then I'm going to integrate by parts to this integration by parts is the same as the second example I put up before. There's no curvature term, and you get from which you can read off that the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion are delta squared phi minus v prime of phi equals zero. Just be aware that the delta squared here is like the space-time Laplacian, the 4D Laplacian. And that contains factors of the metric and Christoffel symbols. For example, in the on the problem set that I'm still putting together, you'll show that in the special case where G is an FRW metric, the 4D Laplacian takes this form. It's more like a Klein-Gordon operator than the spatial Laplacian. The 4D Laplacian in an FRW metric looks like the Klein-Gordon operator, but with this factor of 1 over a squared that's converting like coordinate derivatives to physical derivatives. And then with this term, which is like a Hubble drag term that wants to slow down the evolution of the field phi and set it to a constant. Okay. Well, next, I want to talk about varying the action with respect to the metric. So when I vary the inflationary action with respect to the metric, I want to talk separately about the term where I vary the Einstein-Hilbert action and then the the term where I vary the phi action. So I'll just quote this for the Einstein-Hilbert term. I'll just quote this famous result. And, I vary the Einstein-Hilbert action with respect to the metric and the Einstein curvature appears. That's one way to think about the appearance of Einstein curvature in GR, is that it's just what you get when you vary the section. And then if I vary the rest of the action, or an action that consists of an Einstein-Hilbert term plus some other stuff, which I'll call S phi, then one way of defining the stress energy tensor for a general theory, like our theory of single field inflation, is that if I vary the rest of the action with respect to the metric and write the result this way, then what appears in front of the delta G mu nu is by definition the stress energy tensor with this factor of minus 1/2. Then if I said then the equation of motion will always take the form we'll always take the form of Einstein's equation, like the varying the total action with respect to G mu nu tells you that this left-hand side has to be zero, and that's the same thing as saying that G mu nu is T mu nu over M Planck squared. Okay. So I didn't really calculate much yet. I was just motivating this definition of the stress energy tensor. And explaining that after we vary the action and compute the stress energy tensor, then the equation of motion will be Einstein's equation. I should try to break the habit of writing on the back one that I can't raise. I'm talking about sorry about that. I'm talking about some of these GR foundations in a little more generality than I need. They're fun to talk about, and I think it's just always useful to understand the ins and outs of GR. So to calculate stress energy tensors in a general theory, you vary the action with respect to the metric. This unfortunately can be notationally awkward since GR notation is designed to hide factors of the metric. So for example, suppose that I'm doing some larger calculation where I'm varying an expression with respect to the metric. I encounter something like this, the covariant derivative of a scalar field phi with the index in either the upper or lower position. The delta here means that the context here is that I'm just interested in varying with respect to the metric, not with respect to the field phi. In the first case, you would get zero since the covariant derivative of a scalar quantity does not hide a Christoffel symbol. So it does not depend on the metric. In the second case, the GR notation is hiding this factor of the metric, and the result does depend on G mu nu. And so the variation would be this. Here's a particularly obnoxious one. I've written the definition of the stress energy tensor so that I want to vary the action with respect to the metric and get something proportional to delta G upper mu nu at the end. So suppose that I was varying G lower mu nu. And what I get is with a minus sign. Of course, if I'm varying the metric with the indices in the upper position and writing the result with in terms of delta G with the indices in the upper position, then there's nothing to calculate. There's, in particular, there's no minus. So this expression is, one way to think about it is that for any matrix, delta is any sort of derivative operator, and I'm differentiating a matrix. But there's always this minus sign when I differentiate the inverse of a matrix. I'm just specializing this to the case where G is the 4x4 matrix containing components of the upper metric. Another way to derive this is that if you
G mu nu is constant.
Yeah. You guys know the GR foundations pretty well. You must have a good side GR course. I start with this expression and vary both sides. Let's say that I don't know what I get when I vary G with the indices in the lower position, and I want to solve for that. And then on the right-hand side, I get 0. And then if I take this equation and solve for this quantity, I know this is minus. Or I just get the minus sign because they have to put this term on the other side. That's the end of the hour, so I'll stop here. And